This is The Conversation. I am Michael Shaw. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com. Thank you for being here. This is the Smiley Barnacle episode. This episode was originally broadcast on Kaechung Radio, 1630 AM Los Angeles, kaechungradio.org/streaming. Online, if you care to listen every first Sunday of the month, that is when the new episodes come out with my co-host Margie Schnibbe. So Smiley Barnacle runs Barnacle Brothers Custom Fabrication. We thought it might be interesting for us as well as you to find out what goes into these outsourced complex fabrication jobs that Barnacle Brothers specializes in, and talk with the outsourcee in Smiley, and I think you're going to find it interesting and entertaining, hopefully, as well. By the way, speaking of Kaechung, Kaechung is taking part, is one of the artist collectives in Made in LA 2014, and after about 3 or so weeks from the opening of the show, I finally went and saw it. So again, if you think that I am the media and this podcast is the media, think again. I am not the media. So I went and saw the show, and in the lobby of the Hammer Museum, Kaechung TV, which I believe is the incarnation of Kaechung for the course of Made in LA, was set up, quite a scene with lots of, hangers on, followers, fans, fluffers, makeup artists, and the participants themselves, fully clad in their regalia. It was quite a scene. So if you haven't been to the Made in LA, be sure to check out the Kaechung scene and maybe sample one of their shows, because, you know, it's a completely different deal than what they do on the radio. All right. Hope you enjoy this conversation with Smiley Barnacle. And feel free to check out past episodes on theconversationpod.com. Let us know what you think of this episode as well as any others. And I think that's about it for now. Let's get to the episode, and I will talk to you later. This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw, and this is Kaechung episode number 2. And joining me again in the studio is artist and, let's see, Kaechung fundraiser and camera person and all-around Made in L.A. Supporter. Right? Is that about right, Margie?
I'm there with Kaechung.
Yeah. Margie Schnibbe. Hello, Margie.
Hello.
And our guest today is the entrepreneur and owner of Barnacle Brothers Sculpture and Custom Fabrication, Smiley Barnacle. Hello, Smiley.
Hello, Michael. Hello, Margie. It's nice to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, of course. And so, Smiley, I guess the first question we need to ask is, so you come from a long line of pirates?
I'd say salts, old salts. I'm a younger salt.
You're a younger salt.
Yeah.
Well, is Smiley your nickname that you grew up with?
It's a birth name.
Is it?
Yeah.
What's the story behind that?
Actually, it's not actually a birth name.
I didn't think so.
I'm totally lying. but I have been befriended by a number of barnacles on Facebook, because I guess barnacle is actually a pretty typical English last name. Everybody's English. So I hope to go back to England soon and reunite with all the other barnacles so we can stick together.
What was your birth name?
My birth name is Alessandro Thompson. I came out here from to Los Angeles from Rhode Island by way of New York, and went to CalArts, part of the CalArts Mafia. And I got involved a number of years ago with a group called the Trash Band, which was a sort of a situationalist kind of bombastic street performance rock band that made everything out of trash, and we had some pretty epic shows and parades and we made a number of movies, and at one point I got I was building a piece of equipment for my shop, and the metal grinder got away from me, and it was a big 7/8 metal grinder, kicked back and hit me in the face, knocked my teeth out, and cut my lip off down to my chin, and
oh my goodness,
nearly took my thumb off at the same time. In Faster Than You Could Say, Jack, how you say it? Jack. Faster Than You Could Say Jackrabbit, but it was happened. But
was anybody around when it happened?
No. And I ended up in the hospital and getting my face sewn back together, and it took me a number of years to get my teeth back. But in the time that I didn't have teeth, we Trash Band made a movie called The Pirates Versus the Unicorn, an instant straight to video cult classic, which I implore you to look up and check it out. It's
okay.
Pretty awesome.
Okay.
And so we all needed pirate names, and of course I got the name Smiley because I was missing my teeth. That was kind of a pretty basic one. That was Michael Gump and Colin Barton came up with that, and then they decided, well, you have to have a nautical sounding last name, because you know, if you're going to be hanging out with Buggery Bob and Big Beard and Pelican Pete and all of those guys, you got to have a pretty nautical sounding. So we went to Smiley Clam. Didn't really have the same kind of ring. Smiley Octopus, I was rooting for that one, but it was too much of a mouthful for a guy with no teeth. And so we ended up with Barnacle. Barnacle. So that worked out pretty well.
Have you legally changed your name?
No. Well, yeah. Depends.
Depends on who's asking.
Who's chasing. Yeah. And if and then I ended up on a TV show called Monster House, which is part of the Monster Garage, Monster Nation, like very early original productions, reality shows. And I had a purple mohawk and I had no teeth, and I figured they're just going to make Alessandro Thompson look like a total joker anyway. So I didn't want to ruin my good name. So,
right.
So I told them my name was Smiley Barnacle. So they introduced me as Smiley Barnacle, and somehow, I mean, I don't know if you've watched many of those reality shows, but they're really akin to watching paint dry. And for somebody to come on with an art car and crazy motorcycles and a purple mohawk and no teeth and ham it up for the camera, they made the episode about me, and I even had my own theme song and everything, which is pretty hilarious.
Can we get more specific for a second about your lack of teeth at that time? So basically, you just had like your rear molars.
I busted out my two fronts. It was a classic.
Oh, okay, so it was a classic pirate.
Pirate. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's like a hipster, a really good hipster look. And you had fans from that show, didn't you?
Well, yeah, and so that show was a hit. That was actually the highest rated rerun, believe it or not. And they really loved it, and I was a darling. I was a media darling for, and I got my 13 and a half seconds of fame.
What year was this?
2004.
Okay.
Maybe. And
you decided to abandon reality, the reality and TV world, and get into art fabrication?
Well, I was always doing art fabrication, and I was always, you know, I was kind of a hired gun, freelancing, working in the movie industry, building stuff. And
right.
I didn't like the seasonal sort of feast or famine of the movie industry, and I didn't like having my future decided by an industry. So I got into doing prototyping for toys. I got into doing, I was really interested in mold making and sculpture because I've got a degree in that. And I was also doing animation because I went to school for animation also. So I was building puppets, and I was doing this performance, the Trash Band. And I was taking on jobs for people who need a piece of something.
Mm-hmm.
And then that turned into more. And then I did the Monster Nation, which drew a lot of attention to this Smiley Barnacle character, and people were, like, picking me out in the street and, you know, coming up to me in bars. And it was pretty spectacular that anybody even watched that show. But that I also got to know a lot of the people in that show. So then they went on, and, you know, it was kind of a networking thing, and everybody knew me as Smiley. And then that turned into, oh, hey, Smiley does a lot of the weird stuff. Like, he'll sculpt foam, he'll do mold making. He's also a pretty good welder and, like, does carpentry. And then I started putting all this stuff together, and it started doing more sort of challenging stuff.
And are you, have you been an autodidact? I mean, have you been teaching yourself each of the new, you know, techniques along the way, or did you have a mentor or a combination?
I think every job you take is like a class. Every new job, we kind of learn something new. We don't really ever do the same thing over and over again. We do a lot of fiberglass work over and over again, but everything. I mean, I've made a hippopotamus out of mud. I've made a fax machine out of stone. I've made heads out of Jell-O. I've made machine guns out of soap.
What'd you make the heads out of Jell-O for?
Some artist needed a head out of Jell-O. I don't get all the info and all the time.
So I think we're getting to an interesting sort of backstory or side story to what you do, which is that you kind of keep a distance to a lot of the jobs, you know, because it's like move on to the next one. You know what I mean?
Well, I don't know if I keep a distance, but
it sounds like you kept a distance to the Jell-O heads.
Well, you know, it's kind of. Somebody comes in and they order something, you know, they order something, you get kind of hot and heavy on it for a minute, and then you get paid and you move on to the next one. That's pretty much it. But, right. You know, we try to keep in touch with the artists, and some of the artists in the local area, like Carly Fernandez, you know, we always try to, you know, keep an eye on what she's doing. And, some of the artists, especially the artists we've had a really good experience with, we like to, see them. You know, we like to keep up with what they're doing, like Cara Faye or Earl, and I mean some of the other ones around here. I'm trying to.
Do you want to give us a client list?
I'd have
something.
To read.
Well,
them.
We know. Well, we know. Like it. I know from, you know, from knowing you and looking at your site that you've done stuff for Mike Kelly.
Mark Bradford, Andrew Zittel, Lauren Calzadilla,
Susan Silton,
of course, who's a wonderful, amazing person.
And are you giving her a little pat on the back because she's been on this show?
You know, I actually, Susan Silton, don't take this wrong, Susan Silton, but you're everywhere. For some reason, you've been everywhere, like maybe 5 minutes before I got there.
Because she's amazing.
Yeah, no, amazing. Absolutely amazing. Yeah, she's great. She's such a fantastic person. She's a big fan of ours, and we're a big fan of hers. One of those people who cuts through and touches a lot of other people and through the network. And part of it is doing your work and touching people with your work. But I think another part of it, and I think it's even more meaningful, is like being part of the network of a scene, you know, and I think, you know, Susan Silton's really great, graceful, you know, leading by example, maybe mentor. I don't know if she wouldn't.
Yeah, agree. I agree. She with
wouldn't
you.
Agree. She's
a
mentor,
great.
But yeah,
inspiring.
Yeah.
Since you're talking about community and these kinds of things, I just thought since it's Cake Chung, I should bring up that you also did the fabrication for Jennifer Moon's piece.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And made in L.A. And mm-hmm. I think what's interesting about Jennifer's piece and in the show is that she actually lists all of the people who worked on it. So I don't know if you know this, but Barnacle Brothers gets a credit on the wall in the museum.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So that is very, very cool.
Thank you, Jennifer Moon.
Well, since when did Barnacle Brothers begin, basically, as an entity?
Okay, so going back to this no teeth, being on TV, I ended up with sort of going out on my own. I had my company in my garage, Smiley Barnacle Sculpture and Custom Fabrication, capitalizing on whatever social credit I might have had as Smiley Barnacle, because it's a lot easier to remember than Alessandro Thompson, which I guess is really not that hard to remember, but Smiley Barnacle's got, you know, I mean, it's
rolls
got
off
pizzazz.
The tongue.
It's
yeah.
got, yeah, it's got wow. It's got moxie, but.
And were you getting clients through that sort of burst of fame, as it
were? Yeah, I did. I got a lot of fabrication jobs. We did this giant steel skull for Van Stone. I don't know if you're, that band might still be around. They're
no.
picking up where Spinal Tap left off.
Oh, okay.
We made these guitars that were like these axes, battle axes.
Right.
Totally awesome. just little jobs here and there. And, you know, sometimes you're just building like some piece of something for something, you know. And I mean, but whatever. One thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. And then you get a juicy gig doing something that's actually kind of exciting. And so I was doing that. I was working for Lauren Calzadilla. I'm not totally sure how they found me. I think they found me through Art in General in New York. And they are, I guess, Art in General through Nancy Burson, who's actually another character very much like Susan Silton in terms of people who have touched a lot of different lives in a lot of different ways. I'd done a piece for Nancy Burson. I have no idea how she got my name, but she gave my name to Art in General. Art in General hired me for Laurent Calzadilla. We did some... hot plates. We made some hot plates that had the United Nations symbol in the shape of a hot. It was a hot plate in the shape of the United Nations symbol, mm-hmm. And then that led to, oh yeah, we like that so much, so we're hiring you to do something else. And they're based in Puerto Rico. I didn't meet them for the first 3 years, so they had no idea I was some guy working out of my garage. They just knew I was good and cheap. And I finally met them. Well, anyway, so. I was still Alessandro Thompson. We're still Art Fabrication. I wasn't really a company or anything like that. And then that turned into the Smiley Barnacle thing. That turned into I needed a bigger shop after we went to the Venice Biennale, and we built a hippopotamus out of mud for Laurent Calzadilla. Came back from that, and then we needed more shop space and bigger garage. We needed a place where the wind didn't blow through it, and
right.
lights and concrete floors and stuff like that. So we moved into 5230 Alhambra Ave with three other people, Chris Barber, aka Chico Cabra, and Brian Lethko and Peter Carrillo. Brian Lethko wanted to start a brewery, so he started a brewery in the metal shop, which is pretty funny. And then Chico wanted to, well, he was always been a prop maker, and he still is, so he wanted space to, you know, work out, you know, to, so he and I kind of went in together. And then Pete Carrillo wanted a painting studio. Pete Carrillo is, I mean, going back to this kind of theme, I guess, of community that we're kind of developing here, is that Pete Carrillo is he grew up in East LA. He grew up in Highland Park and Commerce and all that. Knows all of the old sort of community artists, painters, East LA painters,
mm-hmm.
Just because he grew up with them. People like Magoo, you know,
I don't know who Magoo is, but I feel like I should.
He's kind of like right at the top of the list of like East LA artists. I mean, when I was in Highland Park, I mean, we're right down the street from Red Rock Rose Gallery, which had a lot of, was sort of a storage space for a lot of Cheech Marin's collection of East LA art, because he's like one of the foremost collectors, I guess.
Right.
Patricia Correa, there's this weird connection, you know, so... Pete Carrillo knew all of these guys. He knew all of the people around here. He knew all of the old, like the street streetscapers who had did all of the murals on the DMV in like downtown and East LA and stuff like that. They got a lot of the public projects in like the 70s and 80s and 90s, and he knew all of these, like graffiti artists, mm-hmm. like Shandu, Shandu One, Pac, Gaby 88.
How is
the LA Bomb Squad?
How are the painters going to impact your business?
Well, it's part of the, I kind of used to joke, like, I want to know everybody in Los Angeles. And, all of these circles kind of go around in circles, you know? So then they had that big show, Phantom Sightings. the history of Latino art at LACMA. That, of course, we made a couple of pieces for Los. We made a piece for Los Hijackers, and we made another piece for Alejandro Diaz, who's another amazing, great, awesome person, aside from being an incredibly hilarious artist.
Mm-hmm.
And
excuse me, those are the signs, right?
The signs, yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay,
make,
right.
Yeah, Make Tacos Not War, the world's largest cardboard sign.
Right, so for people not familiar, because I actually saw this, it's in the tradition of cardboard panhandling signs, for lack of a better word, there was in the show that was in the gallery in Chinatown, there was a cardboard sign that was like, what, 10 or 12 feet tall? And you guys fabricated that?
Yeah. Yeah, and
so he didn't just find that piece of cardboard.
No, it was actually because we made for him at that LACMA show. We made these giant donation cans, so that like you see at the taco joint, it's like a can. It says, you know, like my mother's got cancer, so if you put like you know, a nickel or a dime in there, it'll help pay for her cancer. It's like, I mean, whatever. But so we made like 5 foot tall versions of these coffee cans that had like a photograph on it. It was handwritten, and his whole directive is to make it as if giant hands made them. And that was kind of what we went off of when we made the world's largest cardboard sign. It was just everything had been stuck into the expando ray, you know, and just like, you know, made it bigger. So we made all the cardboard, and actually, if we had only used cardboard, we could have gotten it in the Guinness Book of World Records as the world's largest cardboard sign.
Which is how big?
Well, it's 12 feet tall, 12 feet by, I think, 12 feet, 12 feet by 16 feet, something like that.
Is what yours was?
Yeah.
But what was the world record?
I don't think there was a previous largest cardboard sign.
What was yours made out of?
But then? We had used wood and we had used cloth in there because we didn't know that we were going for a record.
Right.
Otherwise, we would have figured out how to make it all that cardboard. But
did you have to do pulping and that whole kind of thing?
What we make all of the corrugations out of other cardboard, and it's just to get in. It gets complicated really quickly.
Yeah, I mean, you know? But that's the thing. I mean, there's
we use like giant magic markers to do a giant magic marker. You know?
Right, right.
I just remember at one point we were trying to find really big Scotch tape and really big masking tape. And I remember I went down to a McLogan sign store downtown there. And I'm like, is there anything you guys know where I could get like just the widest roll of masking tape? And they're like, oh, it's right over there. It's on the wall. How wide do you need? 10 inch, 18 inch, 24 inch, 48 wide inch masking tape? I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, it was like, you know, so we cut it so it looked like you just ripped it off the,
right,
you know, the spool and stuff. But, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so we went to, the Phantom Sightings show, and it was kind of like, I walked into the opening and I'm thinking like, oh, I don't know. I've never been invited to an opening at LACMA. And it was like, I knew everybody there. Everybody who was there was like all of these people I'd met through Peter Carrillo, over the years. And of course, you know, all the old, you know, crabby painters are like, I'm just pissed I'm not in this show. You know, Ruben Ortiz Torres, of course, is there. I won't dish on that guy, but, I worked for him at one point he was another one of the sort of early art fabric, kind of contracts that I was working with.
Let me change the subject for a second, because as you're talking about being connected to, you know, all these different circles in LA, and you're also talking about access to these materials, you know, that you would have a hard time finding elsewhere, I wonder if being in LA is like a huge benefit production-wise. Is prohibitive if you're like in New York or somewhere else in the country. So having the cosmopolitan element and also the materials element makes you, you know, in really valuable across the country for production possibilities. Well, here's another follow-up question. Mentioned this Puerto Rican team. How many, what percentage of your business is out of city or state?
80% of our business comes from outside of Los Angeles.
Oh, wow. That's huge.
That's maybe
gigantic.
More.
Gigantic. Yeah.
I mean, the real business comes from out of the city. The biggest client we had here was Mike Kelly while they were sort of contracting stuff off to us. I just thought of another incredibly career-killing, embarrassing moment.
Okay,
that I could probably
why,
talk
why
about
we,
with Mike
why
Kelly.
Why don't we get into it
with
right
Mike
now.
Kelly? That's a good one. That's a good one because you know, because I'm in no danger of losing a contract with him at this point. I think
gallows humor.
No,
appropriate to the pirate
no.
ship. Okay,
he's
go
a,
ahead.
Well, actually, we have this book right over here, the Mike Kelly Candors.
Right.
We met through Rachel Neubauer, who, I don't know, friend of a friend, got wind of us. They were building the Candors series, which was Superman's hometown, the city of Kandor, has been depicted a number of times over the years in Superman comics as, you know, looking one way or another. And it's always in a giant glass bottle. So at the Mike Kelly retrospective, there's like a segment of one of those pieces that was there. I mean, Mike Kelly's work is immaculate, is absolutely immaculate. The quality of the craftsmanship of the people who work there are amazing. Rachel Neubauer is like so incredibly detail-oriented about what she does there.
What was her position with them?
She was one of the leads. I'm not exactly sure, but she was always one of the sort of the senior sort of fabricator builders
in his studio,
mostly handling a lot of the plastics and stuff like that. So she always called me up and be like, you know, when she was stumped and needed to come up with some other way of doing it, so
mm-hmm.
or maybe even just to validate whatever she was thinking about. And so that turned into like, oh, let me talk to Abel, who is Mike Kelly's studio manager for years and years, who is a Hawkeye. I mean, that guy, he could see a detail before he even walks in the building. You know, I think he's got like x-ray vision. He's so, I mean, that's his job, you know, and as he said, it's like, it's my job to make sure that everything comes back right. Incredibly detail-oriented. I think he's fair most of the time. It was always pretty fair. And we did a job. We rebuilt, what was it? It was like a room. We rebuilt a piece that Mike had built years ago for a German museum, because I guess it kind of fell apart because he had built it years and years ago in like his garage or something. And it was a German, it was like a club hall or something like that had a bunch of paintings. And there are these beautiful stage set. It was a beautiful, beautiful stage like set. And the quality of the Mike Kelly work was everything is just absolutely immaculate. Whether it's the backside of a stage set or the front side of it, everything is perfect. And Abel had set the bar pretty much for all of the vendors that everything had to be absolutely perfect. So if a seam is specced to be a 16th of an inch wide, it better not be 3/32, because he could see it. And if... they sent back a bunch of stuff that we cut that was a millimeter off. It was cut by computer, a millimeter off. Turns out our guy who had CNC'd it, he hadn't fully recalibrated his machine, so it was off by a millimeter. And that was a big millimeter. Anyway, that's the kind of stuff. And, you know, anybody who's ever worked for him knows, you know, very detail-oriented. And, you know, I mean, to Abel's credit, that's his job, you know. And I think sometimes you work with studio managers is almost more kind of concerned about the details than the artist is, because they have to provide a certain level above, you know, they have to keep the artist happy.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're always like, if the quality is always higher than the artist expected, then they're always happy. So that's kind of the way they keep it. Anyway, so we built this piece. And I had a partner working for me, somebody was working with me, and it was just one of those, I don't know, the job got away from us. It was like...
Was it just the two of you at the time?
No, it was, well, we had a crew of maybe four of us were working on it, and it was one of those, I should have been way into it more, I should have been way on top of it. But so the guy was running it, and he wasn't really paying attention to it, and he had kind of attendance difficulties, kept not showing up, and things weren't getting done, and... as the deadline looms and the deadline looms. And I just remember we had one guy who was just too happy with the drill. He was just drilling the holes in something and they were too big. And we're like, all right, we just wasted all that material. We got to make this work. Nobody really figured it out until the stuff had gone down and gotten powder coated, right? And it was like, whoa, it was your job to check this out. And, you know, and then it came back and they put it up there and it was wrong. And we all knew it was wrong. And it was up high and nobody's going to notice it. Abel came walking in. He was just like, and it's really funny because everybody has a really great Abel McCone impression, which is really great. But
how would you characterize it? Very studious.
Well, he walks in and he has his finger on his mustache. He has kind of like one hand, sort of like kind of a fist clenched in front of his mouth,
right,
and like his elbow on his other hand,
kind of
crossed arms.
Classic sort of kind of the pensive, observational,
pensive, yeah. Right? And he would kind of look and be like. And then when you get kind of like, you could tell he's getting pissed off, he'd kind of like scratch the back of his head and he'd look around like this. He kind of looked to the side and he's kind of scratched the back of his head really hard. Like he's going to rub off the back of his head. And he walked in and just like, and it was like, it was so down to the wire too. And that thing was like, had to go out. And it was like, what? Like, and I'm like, what? What? You know, I couldn't, I'm like, And my foreman, my other foreman at the time, he was running. He's just like, don't worry. You know, he's a really calm guy. He's used to like studio people freaking out on him all the time. Real calm. So he's kind of, you know, he's like, well, you know, I think it's going to be all right. You know, and Abel's kind of like, he's like, what's that? Why is that not? That's wrong. And then we're like, he's right. It's wrong. And then it was like, is this going to be, we have 24 hours. You know, how is this going to happen? And it was like, I remember Frank was like kind of talking him down, talking him off the ledge. And at the whole time, it was like Aerosmith was playing, like really loud. I mean, what's that famous Aerosmith song? It's like, dude, looks like a layer. One of those like just awful
songs. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was just going, it was like the whole time, Abel's sitting there, you can see he's like totally, like steam is starting to come out of his ears. And and Aerosmith is like just like, you know, like the long guitar solo, like, and he didn't even say anything. He just kind of, he goes, Aerosmith fucking sucks. And then he just like walked out of there. He walked out of the shop. And it was like, we're all kind of like, oh God, he's pissed, right? And we never got any work from them after that. And it was such a bummer because, I mean, we were kind of in line to remake the Candors. I don't know. I think that job went to Carlson or something, but it was like a $2 million, $8 million job or something. Jesus. They're gonna basically buy us out, not buy us out, but they're gonna like, we were gonna basically sign a contract that we weren't gonna take any other jobs, and they were gonna provide us with X amount of
for work, what length of time?
Until that project was over. And it took them 2 years to do the last one, and it cost them like whatever $2 million. They sold it for $20 million twice. But anyway, that was a classic, like, how did we screw that up?
Right.
And that was when I started realizing you can't trust anybody to work for you, and you can't trust anybody. Like, I can be incredibly detail-oriented, and I can be incredibly good at what I do, but that doesn't mean the person who's working for me is. But I have to make sure that what they do is good enough.
So in retrospect, was it the fact that you hadn't been working with that person long enough?
No, we had three other jobs going at the same time, and
so you were overworked. Only so many,
yeah. Well, it's kind of like, hey, you guys are all totally capable of doing this, you know. And they're all people who I had worked for in the past, who I ended up hiring because, you know, that's just how it goes sometimes. And you know, there's no reason why they couldn't have pulled it off, except for the fact that it didn't get pulled off, you know? And so at this point now I have kind of a hierarchical situation. We don't have brothers so much, even though we have kind of a brotherhood aspect to this place. And you know, I will you know, any one of my guys who works for me, I'm ready to drop everything and go pick them up at the airport in the middle of the night, or, you know, if anybody needs a hand, or, you know, we're down. But, and that, I mean, that's kind of, we've always kind of had that aspect, but now it's a little bit more hierarchical, you know, I'm the boss. And I've,
I noticed that you have,
as much as I hate to be the boss, I am.
You have punch cards. What's the story with that? Is that just a practical business running element?
Oh, yeah. You have to.
Why?
Well, you have, say you have five jobs and you have five processes on each job. How do you know how long it took you to, say, sand the lamp shroud as opposed to lay up the lamp shroud as opposed to create the lamp shroud? And then how do you remember that, you know, as opposed to sculpting the giant Hennessy bottle, you know, how much time.
So you're just keeping a record of the length for each job.
Yeah, and we go back and we look at those because everything we do is a little different. However, right. We know that, like, at some point, after analyzing those over years, we know that carving styrene foam is roughly $1,000 a linear, a vertical foot, if it fits into a certain footprint. We know that from analyzing our time cards.
Does working on a time card, I mean, this is something that your employees maybe would not be very frank about, but does that create a different kind of element of alienation, though? You know,
no.
The worker bee?
No. I mean, I clock in on stuff. I clock in. I mean, it's more tying to the jobs because every job has a certain amount of money attached to it.
Right.
And I mean, this is so totally basic, like, business for any other business. However, the only thing that might maybe seem anomalous is the fact that it's an art business. We're making art as opposed to boxes. We're making art as opposed to, like, saw blades. We're making art as opposed to building engines, you know, where we're not doing the same thing over and over again. But some of it, you know, my job is to kind of recognize what patterns and rhythms, you know, are regular and what are totally one of a kind. We're never going to repeat again, you know?
Right.
So,
I mean, I think all businesses have some form of time card so you can figure out how much everything costs, so you know how much to charge, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, when you say business, I mean, I think we should be a little more specific because, you know, there are office jobs, obviously, where, you know, time cards are not used.
I think what's interesting is if artists actually used time cards, they would see how little they were paid for how much work they did. You know, it's kind of an interesting concept just about that, which is what they tell you, you know, when you apply for your creative capital grant or one grant or another, you know, make sure you factor in your time. And artists, lose track of how much time they actually spend making things or writing things or doing bookkeeping or housekeeping, whatever it is, to make a business work. And what you have here is a really, I think, amazing business model, because I've seen you go from having, you know, a shop in the backyard of your house and then growing into this, like, amazing warehouse. And it's impressive. It's very, very cool.
Oh, shucks, Marty. Thanks.
Well, why don't we, since you mentioned Carlson, you know, as sort of being your nemesis, at least in this particular case, why don't you do us the favor of talking about who they were/are, if they still are, I don't know if they are, and kind of how, you know, you seem to have survived, whereas they seem to have not. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think I could probably talk about Carlson in, like, a bigger context of art fabrication. I mean, four years ago, a kid came to me and said, I want to be an art fabricator. Because it's like, is that even a career path? Like, I never really thought of it as a career path, like, art fabricator. But, I mean, the fact that there's enough work in the world, in the art world, to support me, Carlson, Handmade.
Where's Handmade?
They're like an offshoot of Carlson. Carlson kind of, like, split up when, and I mean, near as I can tell, I mean, you can research this stuff and probably get much better answers. But basically what happened is he had a major client. His major client was Jeff Koons. Jeff Koons spends a lot of money at a huge place like Carlson where there's a lot of overhead. They got 100 people working there. They got a huge space. They got all kinds of equipment, insurance, blah, blah, blah. you got to have like a big job that kind of keeps it all. We got to have a regular client that spends a lot of money to keep the doors open when things are slow with the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
However, what that client does is they tell you to kind of stop everything else you're doing and do their stuff. And you kind of got to listen. And what I can gather of what might have happened was that I think Carlson both he was involved in a lawsuit with like a giant bow tie, a giant bronze bow tie, I think, that was engineered wrong or installed wrong, or he got sued for a grip of money. At the same time, I think he got in a kind of a standoff with Jeff Koons about something. I mean, I could be wrong. I'd love to hear the story, but I don't know those guys. I met Mr. Carlson.
What's his name?
Paul Carlson.
And was he?
I call him Mr. Carlson.
Was he involved in the production, or was he just more of the owner / overseer?
He's the boss. He's the big boss.
But was he involved in fabrication?
He's involved in
too.
Everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he's involved in everything. I mean, at some point you become a suit because your talents are best needed talking to clients.
I mean,
had a crew of project managers, and right. of which Mark, what's his name over there, is the from Handmade, was one. And then, I don't know. I don't really want to talk about Carlson because it's like, you know, there was a couple of art fabrication places starting in the 60s. There's like Gemini Gel, and then there was Carlson, and there's another guy out in Ventura or something like that. I can't remember his name. Judd Fine gave me the whole rundown at one point. And they did it all in Los Angeles and probably other places too, probably San Francisco, stuff like that. Gemini Gel, what did Gemini Gel do? They do prints.
Yeah.
How come nobody thinks of that as art fabrication? People printing. You know?
I think the implication, though, with fabrication is sculptural. It's more, you know.
I think that's the implication, but that's totally not the case. I mean, there's what's his name?
We need to look up the word fabricate. That's what
well, and then well, I mean, then there's the other fellow who did all of Mike Kelly's prints and stuff. He's a art fabricator, but he's doing large format prints, like beautiful photographic prints.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, I think if it goes into an art gallery, it's art fabrication, whether it's a print, a painting, you know. And I mean, it's weird because years ago, and when we were in Italy, we were talking to a guy who used to be an art fabricator. He's like, "Oh, you're an art fabricator," you know. And he was saying about how he used to work with this other famous artist making jewelry and stuff like that, and he did all of the work, and then artists would come by and be like, "Yeah, I like it, I hate it, you know, I like it, I hate it." And so we're kind of going back and forth on that, which is really interesting. Like, he's a much older guy, so he'd been around for decades doing this, and he was saying, I'm like, "So you're a studio assistant?" He's like, no, we're actually doing the artwork for the artist, but we work, you know, in conjunction with him. We call the artisti secondi, the second artist. So you're kind of like a designer in a way, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? But over time, I think it's turned into a career path where, you know, I think people want to make more handmade stuff. They want more customized stuff. You know, technology is becoming more accessible to people. I mean, you know, you've got a computer sitting right there, which has got more computing power than the first original supercomputer that took over a whole room. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like all of that stuff in like digital printing and CNC, and you know, you can buy a skill saw at Home Depot for less than $100. You know, and you can buy all of that stuff. It's really accessible now, so people are getting hands-on-y. But I guess what I'm getting at is that the nature of it is there are a lot more, and also I think the economy has gone downhill to the point where a carpenter who would not want to take a chance on some kind of sculpted weird thing is going to take a chance because they're broke. I'm like, well, I don't know how much to charge for it. I'll just run a number up the flagpole. So I'm running up against those people, even though I've got, you know, probably 10 more years experience than, you know, 85% of the people who are doing that out of their garages.
So you're saying business is a little tight?
It's really competitive. It's really competitive. Plus now that there's places like prop shops, Cinnabar, classic example. Prop shops, they go into museum installations. So basically it's like nice props. And then the nature of the art world has become like, oh, we got a festival coming up. Let's make a piece of art. And so you're working now instead of like, oh, let's make the piece, figure out what it looks like, take our time, really be happy with it, and then show it. Now it's like, hey, we got a show. Let's come up with some artwork, which is very similar to like event production,
mm-hmm.
You know, doing parties. It's very similar to rock and roll stages where they'd be like, you know, we got to make this thing now, you know, and very similar to movie stuff.
But that's a very, that to me, just listening to this, it sounds like a different sort of style of working. Like, for example, I think it was Matt Lucero who said to me that, you know, he had this idea to make a piece. I don't know if it was the stone beatbox piece or something, mm-hmm. but that he came to you and you problem solved with him, and you, as a fabricator, you're not just making the thing, but you're working with the artist. They have an idea. They sort of know how to make it or they don't. And then you sit down with them and you help them and you go through the whole process,
right.
Which is very different than just saying, I need this big stage. You know, it sounds like a very different yeah. process than just a sort of entertainment or prop thing because of the level of detail and the sort of conceptual aspect. And you can talk to an artist about that. Whereas a prop person, I don't think that they have that ability and that talent.
Right.
I mean, that's the difference between just a fabricator and then just a builder, let's say, or a prop right. maker.
And I think, I guess what I'm, the comparison I'm trying to draw is that between artisans who are used to making like one-off custom weird stuff, the people who fall into that category are people who are doing decor, people who are doing props, and then also maybe people who are doing some sort of furniture, or actually I find that people who can do like auto, motorcycle, and boat fabrication tend to be the most easily adaptable. But nobody's going to go to a guy who builds boats and say, hey, can you make this piece of art for me?
Yeah.
Unless it's a boat.
Well, maybe, right, yeah, right, totally. But the boat guy's going to be like, you want a boat, but a bunch of holes in the floor? You know, yeah, whoa, that's not what we do, sorry, buddy, you know? And a lot of places, and that's why I exist, because I'll be the guy who goes to that guy. You know, I'm sort of a middleman at some point where I'll be like, oh, I have to hire somebody who's way better. Okay, classic example. We build Andrew Zatel's floating island at 100 acres at Indianapolis Museum of Art. 2011. Maybe.
100 acres?
The 100 acres at Indianapolis Museum of Art is a bequest of 100 acres that somebody gave them to develop as an art park. So they hired a bunch of artists to design artworks for it. Andrew Zatel designed a floating island. And so
you built it.
I built it, yeah. And it was the second floating island. The first floating island she built with her boyfriend at the time. And it was a very different thing that she wanted. I think the second one she built was, I don't know, built in conjunction with some people in another country. And then she had me build this one. And I was like trying to figure out, you know, how do we do this? How do we do it for our budget? How do we do it on the timeline? Blah, blah, blah. And how does it float? Okay, we're going to build a floating dock. It's my job is to break it down. She's got this big idea. This is my vision. I got to take it from there and I got to turn it into like some sort of reality. And we got to do it on a budget. We got to do it on a timeline and we have logistics. So this is going to go in Indiana. So if I'm going to build it in Los Angeles and then we're going to bring it to Indiana, there's a certain aspect of transportation has to be built in pieces. And then, we wanted to build it like a boat so that it would have the properties of a boat of floating and waterproof and stuff like that. But in the end, it had to be floating on a dock of some sort. It had to be on something that floats. What floats? Boats, docks, a duck. No. So we hired a guy out there, Floating Docks Incorporated, right? hey, can you build us a round dock? Whoa, that's some crazy stuff. We usually build square docks, right? So I had to talk them into like, I'm sure we can do it, you know, because they're hungry for the money, you know. For, I don't know, $15,000, they just like built it using the technology that's tried and true, guaranteed, insured, engineered. And
so they built it. What was your role in this?
Well, they built the dock, and then I built the rest of the sculpture on top of
it.
Oh,
I see. So he built
the floating dock, and I built the sculpture. Plus, right. I was the guy who knew to call him. So my job is to figure out what are we doing here, you know?
Can I go back to another part of your business? You know, because you're making it sound like, you know, as you said, business competitive. Is one of your other roles finding new work as opposed to just it coming to you?
Oh, all the time.
So what does that entail?
It entails going on the radio and talking to people about what you do and coming across as an educated individual.
How do you think this is going?
Talking about the strengths and the, you know, the weaknesses. Well, you know, every job that comes in, we ask where how they heard about us. And we get a lot of stuff actually off the internet now. So
through your site.
The portal, yeah, the portal, that window that you can look into,
yeah,
that you can find us is barnaclebrothers.com. That's barnaclebros.com. It's in a constant state of flux of trying to keep that updated, manageable in a way that people who may not have the patience to actually look at all the photos.
But you don't actually literally have the time, or it's not really your role to sort of be like you were describing Carlson as this, the suit, you know, who kind of goes out and...
Oh, I'm the suit.
So are you spending a lot of time out of the studio? What are you doing?
Yeah, no, I'm not. In fact, my big complaint is that I don't get to spend enough time on the floor. But at this point, I'm trying to keep everything manageable because of how times are, and because of sort of the size. It's important for me to recognize the size of the company I am, and not try to waste my time on tiny little jobs,
right?
And not try to shoot for the really big jobs that I don't have the facility for. But everything that comes in gets a quote, and I have to also discern between who's just wasting my time trying to fill in their quote quota and who's actually serious.
Right.
Most of our work comes from referrals. So the best advertising I can do is making sure that I leave a trail of happy people behind me. Every artist who comes in, I need to pay attention to what they want and give them as much as what they want as they have enough money to pay for.
Right.
And that is number one advertising. That's why I'm here still. At one point, a number of years ago, I had another manager who was kind of trying to take the reins and push things in a direction I didn't want to go by hiring a lot of cheap labor that wasn't very skilled and, you know, telling me to stay out of the shop so much. And we quickly cultivated a bad name for ourselves. And it is so much harder to live that down than it is to stay on top of your game.
Yeah.
Because you have to work harder. And when the jobs don't come, then you still got to pay rent. And I mean, it's better to have too much work and turn people away. So number one job is to make sure that the jobs go out on time, looking great. The other thing is to just stay in touch with the people who have come and gone. Also, you know, just keep on top of what's happening in the art world, you know, see who's what.
Right.
Everybody who calls us up, we research them before they even get here.
Sure.
So we know who we're talking to, because you never know. You have no idea who you're talking to, ever. Especially in LA, everybody's so casual. You know? I mean, because, you know, the art world is small. The art world is not just small in Los Angeles. It's small in New York and Berlin and London. And, I mean, people travel. Everybody moves around and everybody talks. The stuff goes to an art fair and it's seen by a million people. And then it gets printed up in a book and it's still being seen years later. You have to do good work. And, I mean, we're pretty committed to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to just you know, leave a trail of happy people behind us.
Yeah. How many of there are you now?
We're on a pretty regular 5 to 8 people working here.
It looks like you only have a couple today.
Yeah, it's pretty slow today. Okay. One guy, my welder's somewhere else. My other guy is out sick, and then another guy's on vacation. It's actually this is kind of funny. It's like sort of dead today for some reason.
Yeah, well, I guess that's good timing.
And it looks like you were just shipping something out too this morning. Or?
No, we actually were receiving something. Okay. We shipped out a big job for Jason Mewson a couple of weeks ago that showed in New York. Couple of 10 foot tall sculptures. That's actually those which were he gleaned from Nancy comics. Nancy went to an art gallery and she saw these sculptures there, and so he wanted us to make them like
Nancy
10 feet
seems
tall.
To be popular in contemporary art. So yeah. How many jobs do you have going at the moment?
Right now we have one. We have a lighting, we're building lamps for somebody. We've got something for Hank Willis Thomas, which is we're making the rest of an edition of 3 of a tip-off sculpture, which is just seen at Freeze. And then we've got something coming up for Jason Mewson, I guess. We're making molds of some other stuff. I got a couple other things pending, but I'm working on some of our own projects. We're also building, I'm building all the tables for Burma Superstar, which is a restaurant group in San Francisco. I'm really excited about that because I get to design them and build them, and it's for a whole new client, and the client's awesome and the people are cool, and it's in San Francisco, and it's gonna be
Burmese food.
It's Burmese. Yeah, Burma Superstar is actually like a pretty well-known Burmese restaurant in San Francisco.
I hadn't heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are two of them in there's two of them, soon to be 3, in San Francisco, and then there's two in the East Bay.
What is Burmese food like? Do you have an idea?
Well, that's what I asked. That's what I asked Desmond. He was like, I'd never had Burmese food, and he took us there. And it was so busy, he couldn't even get a table in his own restaurant. How about that, right? And he said, it's kind of the intersection. He's like, well, Burma has its own food. It's been a country for over 2,000 years. I was like, okay. He said, it's kind of the intersection between Indian, Chinese, and Vietnamese.
Sounds okay.
It's awesome. It's pretty good. And anyway, I'm excited because he's like, I want you to do whatever you want. I want you to make it really good. And he had a couple of stipulations.
Well, I'm curious, though. You say, you know, we have our own stuff. So you call this job your own job as opposed to, like, doing stuff for artists. So this is because this is going to be Smiley Barnacle tables in this restaurant.
Yeah, it'll be Barnacle Brothers, yeah. We're trying to branch off into building furniture, like of our own line, and it's mostly studio built, low volume. Right. It's not like, you know, we're not cranking out a factory of stuff, but handmade pieces that are like art objects. They're, you know, signed a number.
Like Roy McBacon, perhaps, would be the best example.
Yeah, or Gary Knox Bennett, who's kind of a hero. Also from the Bay Area.
So I have one more question for you. The guy who came to you and said, I want to get into art fabrication, did you hire him?
Yeah, I hired him. He worked out great. Yeah, he was a kid. He didn't know anything, but, you know, he learned
a lot of stuff. But he's no longer here.
He went to college.
Oh, yeah. So he was really literally a kid.
Yeah, he was like 21, 20. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Got it. Is he going to come back?
He might. He may. I've got a pretty good crew now. My crew is better than I've ever had, and I've gone through a lot of people. I mean, it's like the stories, but yeah, boy, I've definitely learned a lot of stuff the hard way, but, the crew I've got now, it's great. They're young. They're totally committed. I mean, the kind of brothership sense of, like, you know, we're all looking out for each other kind of thing. We're all, you know, and I'm looking out for them and they're looking out for me, and the quality of work, and like if there's a problem, they bring it to my attention, and it's really great, and just like people who just want to get better at what they're doing, and it's amazing, you know.
And you seem like a pretty benevolent boss. Is that about right?
Yeah. I mean, except for when I'm a jerk.
Oh, you're a nice guy.
I'm not a jerk. Yeah.
Margie, thank you so much. Smiley, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Go to theconversationpod.com to find all past episodes. And thank you very much for listening. And
we're out.